Today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter our promo code LAWPOD30. That's $30 off your first week of HelloFresh.
I declare bankruptcy!
Congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Tax mentis incendium gloria calcum etc. memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair, you have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 130. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am basking in the warm glow of Alabama's election results, so I'm pretty good. How about you?
I am doing great. I am basking in the warm glow of a post I just saw in our Opening Arguments community, another plug for the Facebook community there, that is the greatest lawyer advertisement I think I've ever seen. We've got
really,
yeah, we've got just a little description. We've got it's a dude and a girl. The dude is like got the Fabio look, kind of back in Fabio's prime, you know, and which was like 40 years ago, and and the girl is also she's good looking too. So they're standing in the foreground. In the background, it's both of them again, but in Tarzan attire. So it's just an excuse to show off. This guy's got some good musculature going, and I guess the girl's pretty cute too. And so it's lost in the legal jungle, and they're Tarzan. It's so good. Oh, it's so good. So there have been calls for us to reproduce that. So I think you need to dust off your loincloth bikini thing, and then we'll reproduce that.
Yeah, obviously, I would be the one in the bikini. So
it is so great. Thank you for whoever posted that, and join our Facebook community, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Just look for Opening Arguments community. It's a lot of fun. And one more great piece of sort of pre-show news. Most people who were affected by this are already aware because we've shared it out on social media, in the Facebook community, on Facebook, everything else. But Patreon has completely reversed the policy we talked about last week. They have reversed that under protest from
basically every
like
single person that they told about it. Yeah.
Yep. Negative, incredibly negative press coverage. I mean, it was a terrible decision, and the core of what made it a terrible decision was Patreon unilaterally said, we're going to interfere in the relationship between our creators, like Opening Arguments, and your patrons, that is the people listening to this show. And they've issued a full retraction and apology, and they've said they're not going to do that again. They have said they're still looking for a way to deal with the transaction costs issue, which, you know, probably means that's something you and I are going to have to shoulder in the future.
What I told my listeners on my show is this was a real wake up call for me, you know, like this is my living. It really put a dent in both our shows just from people being justifiably pissed off at Patreon. I want to thank our patrons for largely sticking with us, but you know, a lot of people made a very rational decision of, oh, Patreon is upping my cost by a lot, so I'm going to have to contribute a little less. And you know, no one can be blamed for that, but it all kind of hit us at once. So that really wasn't fun for us. Patreon really screwed us over. So what I told my listeners, I'm working on a subscription thing for my site. It's something we can probably do for opening arguments as well. And Andrew, we'll be getting rid of Patreon or anything, because in the end, I do think that if people want to stick with what they know, if they want to stick with a website where they can, you know, they can pledge a bunch of different shows and it's convenient or whatever, no hard feelings, but we're probably going to develop a website subscription for opening arguments, and we'll probably throw up bonus material that's only available there, because this was really scary, you know, for me in particular. Yeah. with a newborn child, like, just like, oh, okay, your entire job might just be going away. So it would be good to have a little bit of that under our own control. And turns out I'm able to do everything on the website that we need from Patreon. Most importantly is a Patreon, like a bonus RSS feed with authentication. That's something that I had a long time ago, so I'm bringing it back for me, and I can probably do it for opening arguments as well. So that's what I think about it. But again, it'll in the end, it'll be your decision to make as a patron, as a listener, but we'll probably be offering as many incentives as we can to get people over to the website.
Yeah. In the meanwhile, as a patron, you need to know, or as a listener who has maybe thought about becoming a patron, and with us taking a massive hit, this wouldn't be a bad time to do that. There are no additional fees that are going to be hit to any of our patrons in December or in the foreseeable future. So you can go back. It's still, I think, the most convenient. And obviously there's, you know, all the security regarding your credit card, that sort of thing. And so if you were on the fence, if you pulled your pledge, and you'd like to go back to throwing us a buck and have it actually be a dollar and not a $1.38 or whatever patron was going to turn it into, you can do that. We appreciate it. We greatly appreciate everybody who stuck with us through this confusing time. We pleaded with you in the last couple of episodes to just give us some time. We told you we were lobbying.
Yeah, and it turned out because we did think there was a good chance they would back down on this, because it was a really stupid idea. Yeah. Thanks. And there's a couple more things I want to say, which is, one is, I think you already mentioned it, but I anticipate they're going to do something else. You know, like, as much as this idea was stupid and it got shut down, they have made it very clear that they think there is a problem with their existing model. And who knows what the next thing will be? You know, who knows if it'll be we're paying a much higher fee or you're paying a higher fee. Who knows what it'll be? So that's another reason to get the website going. And secondly, you mentioned security. I opted in what I'm building to just use the same credit card processing that Patreon uses. So I'm using Stripe as well. So it's just awesome. A secure. It's a third party. It's not me doing it or anything. So I wanted to do that on purpose, so it would be as compatible with what people were already doing as possible.
Yeah, we know that our patrons put a tremendous amount of trust in us, and hopefully you feel validated by that, right? I mean, we saw something that was going to, you know, disproportionately hurt you guys, and we tried to get out in front of it, and you know, so far this is a victory for people who support the show. We're super excited about it. We're going to try and do some good stuff for patrons, for those who stuck with us, and just for our listeners in general. It's the holidays, so so thank you all so much.
Great timing, Patreon. Looks like it's thank you. Anyway, enough with that great news. Let's get to the bad news. down. 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 Net neutrality. It's just done, I guess. Just gone. Just no more.
Yeah, look, we said this in our episode 128. Vote was today. My note was the vote will be going on as we record, but actually, Thomas, you got a little update notice, I think, right after we hit the record button, right before it, that said the vote is through and net neutrality has been repealed. We knew this was happening. We knew there was not going to be anything to stop it. And now, you know, we shift our efforts to the things that we discussed in OA 128.
So what is the what can anyone do about this? Are we just done? Like, how soon? Give me, okay, in the liberals' wet dream of the next few elections, like they go really well. How soon could this be changed?
So it depends on what the proponents of net neutrality are going to do and are going to include as part of their lobbying, right? So this goes back to the very first couple of episodes we did about this, which covered the AT&T lawsuit. Traditional net neutrality advocates have, as a part of their platform, regulation of ISPs as Title II common carriers, thus shunting the jurisdiction to the Federal Communications Commission instead of the Federal Trade Commission. If that remains a part of the net neutrality package, then basically you kind of have this ongoing football, right? So you will have a situation where President Elizabeth Warren, our nation's next president in 2020, if she goes along with those recommendations, will have her FCC reclassify ISPs as Title II common carriers, will take jurisdiction back out of the hands of the FTC. It will moot a whole bunch of pending lawsuits and will go to the FCC to promulgate another new version of net neutrality rules, or they could just reinstate the previous ones. As you might guess from my describing that, if I were a part of these groups, and I'm going to try and reach out to like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and some of these groups that are on the forefront of net neutrality, see if we can't get somebody on the show to talk about developing the legal strategy, because my intuition is maybe, okay, let's give on the Title II regulation and work to develop strong guidelines at the Federal Trade Commission under existing antitrust rules that will protect consumers in the same way that the FCC Open Internet Order wanted to do. That's my view right now, just because I would hate to see, you know, this kind of continuing batting back and forth of is it Title II, is it not? And as we showed in our initial episode, reclassifying as Title II will moot any complaints that have been brought over the next couple of years with the Federal Trade Commission regarding unfair practices on the internet. And even Trump's FTC is going to have something there, right? Like there will be, I mean, there might not be much, but there will be pending cases in the next couple of years. So,
but long story short, like even if we just, it's an absolute murder in Congress in 2018, doesn't matter because it's a federal agency.
It's an executive branch agency.
Trump appoints them. Yeah. So it's just, I mean, unless in that absolute slaughter of Congress, we also somehow get rid of Trump and then, well, no, but even then, I mean, still got
Trump, Pence and Paul Ryan. Yeah, I mean, I don't, that man.
So there's no matter how good things were to go, we're stuck with this for probably at least 3 years.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, we are.
Awesome.
And look, yeah. So
it's, I love it. It's a policy no one likes, like literally no one likes.
Except for Jaqen M'Hadar.
Yeah. Jaqen M'Hadar, whatever you just said. And it's like we're hostages to this. It's so frustrating that this could be happening. That's something nobody likes. The other two, there's two people on that board or whatever that were like, this, don't let us do this.
Right.
Did you see that?
Yeah. The legacy commissioners.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gosh. So frustrating.
So you want to be cheered up with the next news item?
I'm sure it'll be something great.
also, breaking news from today. See, we really mean it.
If there's one thing I know about 2017, it's that whatever the next news story is probably going to be heartwarming, cheery. It'll be something about baby ducklings rescued out of a, yeah, I don't know.
The Disney Corporation and Fox have announced a $52 billion merger.
Yeah,
what this
not?
Is going to do is Fox is going to get the $52 billion. They're going to spin off the following broadcast units, right? Fox Broadcasting Network, Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network, sports channels, FS1, FS2, and the Big Ten Network. And that will be the new Fox plus $52 billion, which is not bad for a day's work. Disney will get everything else. So they will get the studios, they'll get the movies, they'll get the shows, they'll get all the intellectual property. And the reason we want to watch this is because this is very, very similar to the AT&T Time Warner deal that we talked about in episode 128, right? Fox is a lot like Time Warner's subsidiary, Turner Broadcasting, and Disney is a lot like AT&T, in particular that Disney is on the record that they are developing a streaming service, right? So whether that's going to be a Netflix like, you know, SVOD, or whether it's going to be a virtual MVPD, Disney wants to develop that. Oh, and I should also add that Fox owns part of Hulu, which of course is an SVOD.
Can't we just make it all one company and just get over with, really? I mean, it's just everything should just be one company.
But we actually get kind of a version of doing a scientific experiment, right? Because the question that we sort of posed into the ether was, you know, is the Department of Justice's lawsuit against Time Warner, AT&T, retaliation against CNN, right? And this is the test, right? The exact same arguments that were made, right? Disney will now have a heightened ability to withhold programming from cable and DirecTV, and it will have a competitor in its new SVOD services. It will have the exact same anti-competitive effect as the AT&T Time Warner in the limited area that lawsuit was brought, right? And it will be very, very interesting to see if Trump's DOJ now,
there's no grudges that Trump has that might impact this, right? We're
Well, Fox. I mean, I think Trump is pretty happy with Rupert Murdoch's
that's
Fox.
That's interesting. Court, so we've isolated the variables there, and we've got a little experiment.
There you go. So we'll keep our eyes on that. And then last kind of piece of news. This is from a couple of days ago. The Supreme Court just denied certiorari in the Evans versus Georgia Regional Hospital case. We discussed that case back in episode 112. And what we discussed uniquely on that, so very, very briefly, Evans versus Georgia Regional Hospital is the latest case to come down weighing in on whether Title VII's anti-discrimination provisions that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex apply to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So we've went into the cases that are on the other side, Zarda versus Altitude Express, Second Circuit, Hively versus Ivy Tech, Seventh Circuit. Those cases have said yes. Evans came out the other way. It was an 11th Circuit case. It's out of Georgia. And the 11th Circuit came out the other way. And what was interesting to us in episode 112 was the amicus brief by 76 corporations, big and small, you know, not all traditional lefty corporations, urging the Supreme Court to take up this case and give us a uniform ruling on Title VII's anti-discrimination provisions and to rule that it does in fact extend to protection on the basis of sexual orientation. The Supreme Court denied cert. They declined to take up that case. So there are several things that means, right? First and foremost, it means, so in the states that are covered by the 11th Circuit, which is Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, this is now the highest authority, right?
Wow.
So if you are gay and you are fired by your employer for being gay, and those three states do not have state anti-discrimination provisions, and I don't think, I'm fairly certain Alabama and Georgia don't, and I don't think Florida does, then under Evans v. Georgia Regional Hospital, you have no recourse. That you cannot bring a Title VII anti-discrimination lawsuit, even if the employer says, yep, I'm firing you because you're gay. So that's bad. And I don't want to lose track as we sort of talk about reading the tea leaves that real people are affected by this. What does it mean for people outside of Alabama, Georgia, and Florida? This is kind of an interesting result. So first, when the Supreme Court declines to grant cert, this is one of the very first things you learn in law school, is that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court approves of the ruling below, Right. And there's a little bit that's kind of counterintuitive about that, right? Like, because typically you're approaching it from the other way. Like you're researching and you're trying to figure out the law, and you see a case and it says, you know, Smith v. Torres, Seventh Circuit, you know, cert denied. And you might be in the Fourth Circuit and you're sort of tempted to go, oh, hey, look, like, if that's the result the Seventh Circuit reached and the Supreme Court said that was okay, isn't that kind of like the Supreme Court saying we endorse this reasoning?
Yeah, it's not.
And it's not. It has absolutely no effect. You are and lawyers are they're not prohibited by any kind of rule. But no lawyer would make that argument in the courtroom. The judge would say, counselor, surely you're not insinuating that the fact that the Supreme Court denied cert here imbues this case with any additional, merit, persuasive authority or other authority in this case. And then that embarrassed lawyer would say, no, of course not, Your Honor. So it does not mean that the Supreme Court endorses the reasoning. But it's also kind of interesting because we've talked about how you only need 4 votes to grant cert. And you would think that based on either side reading the tea leaves, right? You have 4 pretty consistent liberal justices and 4 pretty consistent conservative justices on the Supreme Court. You know, why didn't those 4 band together, right? And the reason is, I think there are 2 reasons for this. So the first is there may be some uncertainty as to where Justice Kennedy is going to come out. I share that uncertainty, and I think I've talked about this, which is
Kennedy shares that uncertainty.
Justice Kennedy has been, as we've said on the show, a very consistent supporter of civil rights, particularly when it comes to LGBTQ issues. But at the same time, this is a tough argument. And we've gone through our Hively versus Ivy Tech episode. We go through all the reasons why this is a tough argument. There's, you know, you've got to go against the weight of several decades of precedent. You have to go against congressional history where, you know, repeatedly there have been efforts to interject sexual orientation into Title VII that have been unsuccessful. So number one, there could be uncertainty. And then number two, the facts of this case are really, really bad. And they're really bad if you are in favor of granting civil rights to LGBTQ and recognizing that Title VII's prohibition on sex discrimination covers sexual orientation. There's a procedural question about whether the hospital was properly served. It claims that it's not an appropriate defendant. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It's super not interesting to get into all the technical stuff. If you're a law geek like me, you might want to read it. But the bottom line is, if your goal is, as the amicus brief set out, to get a clean case before the Supreme Court to resolve the issue uniformly and with finality, this case has some weird aspects to it. And so I think those 2 things combined kind of led the justices to sort of be skittish about that. And I would say, if you're looking on the tea leaves, that probably more skittish on the left side of the aisle, because remember the harm. I mean, that was the first thing we talked about. The harm in letting it stand is, right, in 3 states, this is now the highest authority. It's going to do real damage to real people. And I know that, you know, the Supreme Court justices were cognizant of that, and they had to balance out that harm with, okay, but we don't want to take a case on bad facts and screw up the law, on a nationwide basis. So that's how to read that case.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I guess, is that sort of a good result then? I mean, we wouldn't have wanted something, you know, weird to happen because of a particular case was not, you know, entirely the best facts.
Yeah, I mean, look, the worst case scenario is winding up with something that, you know, mirrors what happened in Trinity Lutheran, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you have a Supreme Court decision on the books that is terrible law. And unlike, you know, when we've talked about this in the, you know, political context, right? Getting a new president doesn't guarantee you a new Supreme Court appointment, and getting a new Supreme Court appointment doesn't guarantee liberal justices, because of the asymmetry that we've long talked about, are going to go back and, you know, sort of immediately get rid of precedent, right? Like if Hillary Clinton had been president and Merrick Garland or someone else had been appointed in Neil Gorsuch's stolen seat, I do not think that a Merrick Garland, you know, led 5-4, 6, or even 6-3, if Kennedy had shifted a little more to the left, court is going to be out there necessarily reversing cases like Citizens United. You would get different results going forward. But again,
I don't want to extend this too long. Yeah. But how would they even do? They'd have to have a case that gets all the way up to them,
right?
Yeah,
and you'd have to explicitly say this case asks us to reverse Citizens United, and we do. Right, okay. This case asks us to reverse DC v. Heller, and we do. And we've talked about that at some length. How, you know, liberal justices tend to have more respect for stare decisis than that. So that's a long-winded answer of, is there maybe some long-term staunching the bleeding that comes out of the denial of cert in this case? There might be.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess so. It's a mixed news there, but
yep.
Where was the good news? I thought there was supposed to be a good. No ducklings were rescued or.
Yeah. Right. No. No. Nothing. Cute baby animals were harmed at all at the Supreme Court this week. So
I guess that's a plus. Okay.
Today's sponsor is HelloFresh. You guys know I love HelloFresh. I'm really, really glad they're back doing a holiday sponsorship with us. It wasn't something that I thought about using HelloFresh over the holidays, but it's really, really a good idea, right? Like, so everybody wants to have, if you're like me, you like to cook from scratch. I want to set up a special, you know, we're doing a Christmas Eve meal at my house. But you put a lot of effort into baking cookies and doing a special meal. I don't know about you guys, but I have relatives, family and friends coming over like the full 2 weeks starting tonight, actually. And I can't do that every single night, right? So having HelloFresh to help be there during this really, really busy time of the year is such a great idea. You know our story of HelloFresh. We say this every time they come back to the show. HelloFresh sends out their ingredients in pre-measured, labeled meal kits, so you always know which ingredients go with which recipe. It comes in right to your door in a recyclable, insulated package. I mean, it just couldn't be more convenient. And HelloFresh offers a huge variety of what they call chef-curated recipes that change weekly. What does that mean, right? That means that you know I like to cook. They give really, really interesting recipes that nevertheless fit in with the plan of dinner from sort of box to table in around 30 minutes or so. And so easy that, like I said, when I get HelloFresh, I often do it side by side with my son who just turned 15. So I want you to take a listen to some of these holiday recipes. Like, I'm super excited about these. We have meatloaf a la mom with roasted root vegetables and thyme gravy, pan-seared scallops with heirloom tomatoes, mashed potatoes, and Meyer lemon. Like, those are really good quality ingredients. The heirloom tomatoes from HelloFresh remain one of my son's favorite side dishes. Figgy pork tenderloin with green beans and rosemary potatoes. So, you know, you have these really cool ingredients, but you have straightforward recipes. Everything is pre-proportioned in exactly the right amount. So you're not sitting around with like 87 extra figs going, what am I going to do with that in January? I love HelloFresh. I think you should use HelloFresh. I think it's a great way to help save time in the holiday season. And And I couldn't be happier to endorse them. And remember, because you're an Opening Arguments listener, because they support the show, go to HelloFresh.com and enter our promo code LawPod30, and you will get $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. That's a great deal. It really, really is. I would encourage you, give HelloFresh a try if you haven't tried it before, and see how much time they can save you with some fantastic recipes in this holiday season.
All right. Well, in our next item here, Andrew, my entire state is on fire. At least the parts that have all the people was entirely on fire. And it's almost Christmas. So could it be our climate's a little different? I don't know. Anyway. what's going on with that? There's an insurance question about this?
Yeah. So, I mean, you are, if anything, saying all of California is on fire almost understates how bad this problem is. I've gone to the California Insurance Commissioner's website. The October wildfires in Northern California alone damaged or destroyed
really bad.
21,000 homes, 2,800 businesses, and did $9.4 billion in damage.
Yeah.
Okay. And
yeah, I know a lot of people who lost their houses. It was really bad.
Yeah. It's as catastrophic as any event, right? In terms of the long-term financial damage. So $9.5 billion just on the October wildfires in Northern California. There obviously were massive fires in LA and Southern California too, that have led Standard & Poor's to estimate that the October fire damage in California is going to be $12 billion. And as you well know, there were fires earlier in the year during the summer. It's all fires here. Yeah. It's a disaster. And so I thought there are kind of two interesting legal deep dives that really leads into, because the first question is, who's going to pay for all this stuff? Right. Yeah. And I think most people think, okay, well, you've got insurance and the insurance companies pay for it. And that's true in some ways, but it's also true that insurance companies try and, their businesses try and recoup the losses that they suffer when you have to pay out on catastrophic claims like this. So, for example, there is some evidence. I've got a statement from an insurance advocate who says that virtually all of the policies that paid off in Katrina were immediately reflected the next year in premium increases for people who had property and casualty insurance in those areas.
I've heard that too, and it's really frustrating to me because it's like, wait a minute, that was the whole thing. That was the reason why you exist, insurance, is some year, most years, hopefully, well, not anymore. Some years there won't be a Katrina. Maybe the global warming has a lot to say about that. But anyway, the idea was like most of the time there isn't some disaster. So you just make money, you just print money because you're not doing anything. And then when there is a disaster, it's like, okay, well, I guess that year you're going to lose money. But it feels to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, feels to me like insurance companies are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We don't like the part where we pay back any money. I thought we just collect money and nothing happens. It seems weird to me.
Yeah, and it seems weird to consumer advocates too. So one of the defining characteristics about California that differentiates it from the Gulf Coast states that were hit hardest in Katrina, and you may want to think about the political aspects of this. In 1988, California put on the ballot a ballot initiative called Proposition 103 that passed. It is now Section 1861.05 of the California Insurance Code. And it provides no rate shall be approved or remain in effect, which is excessive, inadequate, unfairly discriminatory, or otherwise in violation of this chapter. In considering whether a rate is excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory, no consideration shall be given to the degree of competition, and the commissioner shall consider whether the rate mathematically reflects the insurance company's investment income. And then there are subsequent cross-reference provisions that essentially prevent the insurance company from putting all of the losses into 1 year and then using that to go forward. In other words, you have to use risk over time. You have to include the non-Katrina years, the non-wildfire destroying the entire state years in your investment income to cover your rate application. When you go later on, I'm not going to read the rest of the statute, but later on in the statute, it also provides that every time an insurer wants to increase rates, they have to apply. Now, there is a process that if the insurance commissioner does nothing for 60 days, then that rate increase is presumed valid. But there are even some exceptions to that. There's some abilities for the for consumers to become active. There are numerical caps in which a hearing must automatically be held. So the net effect of this is you know really an insurance analog to some of the functions of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that are now being gutted in California, that basically says, hey, insurance companies are not going to be able to turn around and jack up rates on consumers in connection with having to pay out catastrophic losses for wildfires for this year. So good thing. And as far as I can tell, right, like the counter argument is always the, Republican libertarian, these regulations, right? Yeah. The regulations, killing us. Regulations are bad. Yeah.
Regulations are making insurance companies not make billions off of us and then jack up the price when something actually happens.
Look, at the end of the day, the question is the remedy that you have as an insurance company in California is don't write policies in California, right? You don't have to issue fire insurance policies. And look, there are areas where that insurance companies, by and large, that are standard form exclusions from policies, right? You cannot get a policy right now. I don't know why you would want to start a business that worked with asbestos. But if you wanted to start a business and insulate your factory with asbestos, you can't get an insurance policy to cover that, right? The insurers will say, well, look, like we know what's going to happen if you use asbestos in your factory. We're going to have every single person that's ever worked in your factory is going to sue you later on, and we're not going to cover that. So, you know, this is truly an area where you do not need, right, where the free market is a binary decision, right? Are you going to write fire insurance policies or not? And the fact that these companies continue to write fire insurance policies despite the regulatory environment is a pretty good argument against the regulations are killing us. But the insurance companies do have other avenues in front of them, and those avenues are essentially contesting whether the liability comes under the policy. For most people, there will be no such contesting of the language in the policy. But I thought it might be worth going through and talking a little bit about how individuals, and in particular how businesses, because that's where the greater complexity arises, interact with insurance policies. In California, another right evil regulation that doesn't seem to have hurt the market at all, Insurance Code Section 2071 provides a standard form consumer fire insurance policy. And so what that means is the insurance company can't come in. I was an insurance company.
Oh, is this kind of going to be like the Obamacare thing where it's like you can't sell a policy that's just, okay, we actually only cover your window frames in a we'll replace like a 2x4 in your house if it burns down. You didn't look at the details of your plan. We don't actually help with any of the house, just a couple parts here and there.
Yeah, it's better than that, which is to say, so yes, that's exactly right. And the way in which this is done in California and many other states is in the code is this is the policy you have to use. This is the standard form policy. And that standard form policy protects an insured against all loss by fire, lightning, and by removal from premises endangered by the perils insured against in this policy, right? That is, you know, even if your house doesn't burn down, if you suffer a loss because you've got to evacuate because of the fires, that counts. except as hereinafter provided. And then the exceptions are, and there are a bunch, but the exceptions on goods are: the policy shall not cover accounts, bills, currency, deeds, evidences of debt, money, or securities, nor, unless specifically named hereon in writing, bullion or manuscripts. I like that you can write in an exception. So you could get apparently a policy that would cover you for massive amounts of gold bullion,
yes,
in your basement. Those are all very easy. The reason for those exclusions
are the bullion cubes of, like, you know, seasoning or whatever. Like, we can't replace those because if they get wet, then you just have a whole soup in your house.
How great would that be?
The bullion lobby tried to get it in there, but they just couldn't.
Concentrated beef flavor in cube form.
Yeah. If your house is now completely beef flavored, we can't do anything about it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it would smell good in the fire anyway.
Yeah.
And that's there for very obvious reasons. Those are fraud areas of typical fraud, right? Like, you know, oh, look, yeah, I always kept $100,000 under my mattress and it burned.
I really like beef bouillon. I had like a lifetime supply of it. Everybody tries to pull that one. They're like, no, we've heard it before. Come on.
So those are the kinds of items that they won't reimburse. And then there are conditions under which the company is allowed not to reimburse, which is enemy attack by armed forces, invasion, insurrection, rebellion, revolution, civil war, usurped power, or any order of any civil authority except acts of destruction at the time and for the purpose of preventing the spread of fire, provided that the fire did not originate from any of the perils excluded by this policy. All of that is to say, in situations where there might be fire, but in a situation that you would expect the insurance company to be relieved of its obligations, North Korean
war.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. That, you know, in wartime, your house may catch on fire and your fire policy is not going to cover you for that.
Elections have consequences.
But notice that other than that, the policy is pretty wide ranging, and homeowners with fire insurance are very likely to get, because of the operation of these California laws, are very likely to get the full replacement value of the damages.
To try to sum up, it's almost as though consumers can benefit from having protection, but from predatory companies and corporations that just want to make as much money off you as possible. And that protection can be very helpful when your house burns down.
Yes. Okay. And look, and if you're still worried that we're not being fair,
your businesses and ruining all the free market.
Right. And if you're still worried about this being unfair to AIG, for example, there's a burden shifting analysis that goes on in insurance law. And this is an oversimplification, but it's good enough for this discussion. In general, the plaintiff bears the burden of proof of demonstrating that there's a covered loss, right? So here, right, this says against all loss by fire, lightning, and by removal from premises, right? So you have to show that the damages were caused by fire, right? If there was something else, right? If somebody broke into your house and stole a bunch of stuff while the wildfires were raging, right? Which certainly happens. That's not going to be covered by the policy, right? Because it is a different intervening act. You can have different kinds of insurance that protect you against theft, and you won't meet your burden. But once you meet that burden of demonstrating you've suffered a loss because of that is covered by the policy, then the burden switches to the insurer, and the insurer bears the burden of proof to show that on what are called exceptions to the policy, right? To say, no, this, right, the house was on fire, but it was on fire because of North Korean tanks and not because of wildfires.
Right.
And again, seems to be a pretty good balance.
Yeah.
To go super, super briefly into the commercial side, the commercial side is much more complicated because businesses don't get a fire policy. What businesses get are overlapping series of, you typically start with a commercial general liability, what's called a CGL policy. And that insures against all sorts of different kinds of losses. And because it's possible for a business to have, you know, kind of truly catastrophic losses, right? The plant burns down and tens of millions of dollars of irreplaceable equipment go up in smoke. And also businesses have routine losses that homeowners don't have, right? Like when you have a CGL policy, you know, if you have a business that serves the public, you're going to have a certain number of slip and fall cases on your premises every year, right? And so do the insurers. And they're not high dollar value cases, but the insurer knows, unlike with you and I, a consumer policy, the insurance company might say, yeah, well, most years we're going to pay out zero. Some years we pay out $500,000. With a business policy, most years the insurers pay out something, and some years they might pay out $10 million.
Right.
And the way in which businesses deal with that is by segregating out the different kinds of insurance. So you'll have a policy with $1 million in limits that is your primary policy that will protect you against slip and fall cases and, you know, just sort of the average stuff that happens at a business. And then you'll get a policy that sits on top of that that might go from 1 million to 100 million, or you might have multiple levels of policies that sit on top of it that only kick in when that first layer policy is exhausted. And that's called excess insurance. And the excess insurance insures against higher levels of risk, but they're not responsible for dollar one. It only kicks in when you have a catastrophic situation. And the complexity comes from the fact that most consumer homeowners tend to like stick with their insurance company year after year. You just renew the policy, that sort of thing. Businesses don't do that. They solicit new policies every year. Sometimes you have three-year policies. And so businesses will often have a patchwork of lots of different insurers that are on the hook at different levels, right? Different policies stacked on top of each other from lots of different companies. And then all of a sudden, when you get hit with a catastrophic loss, particularly if you get hit with a multi-year catastrophic loss, as some of these businesses will get hit with, then now you have this giant mess where nobody knows who exactly is on the hook for all of the loss. And this is probably worth doing a deep dive later, but again, there are two approaches to this. The consumer-friendly approach is called an all-sums approach. And what it says is any one insurer that has to respond, you as the consumer can allocate all the losses to that insurer. And then the insurers have to figure it out amongst themselves who's responsible for what. But basically, you get paid back first. The other approach is called a pro rata approach, which says we're only going to allocate out the losses pro rata to each of the insurers who are required to respond to the policy in accordance with the risk. But what that means is you have to go to court and establish
right.
who's on the hook for what before you get any of your dollars back. So in general, you know, it's pro-insurer to have the pro-rata approach. It's anti-insurer to have the all-sums approach. I'm way oversimplifying. California is an all-sums state as well. So this is just a really a good depiction of kind of what's the status of the insurance market out there and how are these folks going to get taken care of and what are the issues that arrive.
Yeah. Wow. Really deep insurance dive there. Thanks for that. But it sounds like
I tried not to bore everybody to death with insurance law, but
it's really interesting. I think it really does have implications for the whole argument over like, regulations are just killing us. You know, it's like, well, seem to be pretty helpful here if your house burns
down. And how you can be pro small business, right? And pro regulation. Uh-huh. Right? All sums is very, very pro small business. It's very, very bad for insurers to be in an all sums jurisdiction. So it's it's not as simple as Donald Trump makes it sound.
Yeah. All right.
Political. Political.
All right, let's talk about the tax deal. There, it's reported that they've got something worked out. I suppose there's a lot to talk about. I'm not sure what you intend to go to here, but I'm curious if Doug Jones is going to get a say in this or not.
Yeah, I thought we might discuss that. We might crush everyone's optimism.
Oh, good.
So the directly relevant analogy is, of course, the Scott Brown special election,
yeah,
in which he was seated in 2010. And Democrats, because this is not both sides do this, said, yeah, well, of course, right? Scott Brown is going to sit in the Senate and we're not going to take a vote on Obamacare until Scott Brown sits down. And that greatly increased the complexity of Obamacare. Because the Democrats no longer had 60 votes. It will not surprise you to learn that the Republicans have no intention of doing that with respect to the tax vote, despite the fact that obviously that colored the Alabama election. We have, I pulled the quote from the New York Times, Senator Susan Collins, right? This is the, you know, one of the three or four people you're pinning your hopes on, says, quote, I see no need to wait for Doug Jones to become a senator. We vote all the time in lame duck sessions with retired and defeated members casting votes.
Right.
So if you are hoping that Doug Jones, good, great result, Doug Jones, if you are hoping that that is going to stop this tax bill, that is a forlorn hope. That is not going
to
happen.
It does have some impact, though, right? Because if they need to redo anything in the Senate, then they would have to re-vote, right? Like if
yes.
they, it just depends on how they do the conference committeeing, and if the House just decides to, like, you know, adopt all the Senate's provisions, then the Senate doesn't have to really vote again, right?
That's right. Or if the Reconciliation Committee can reach something that is acceptable to both the House and the Senate, then they can re-vote before Christmas and before Jones is seated, which looks like it's going to be the plan. That I'm going to link the New York Times article. I need to tell you that the reconciliation deal that has been leaked keeps all of the terrible elements from the Senate plan and adds additional terrible stuff. So it keeps the reduction in corporate taxes to, it's now going to be 21% instead of 20%.
Oh, they finally had to go to 21
yeah.
to fix all their errors that they got in there.
Yep. Yep. It keeps the skinny repeal of the Obamacare mandate. Ugh. It keeps opening the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge for drilling.
That's
the
a good tax. I definitely, yeah. when I fill out my taxes every year, I think, you know what we really need to reconsider is the drilling policy in Alaska as part of a tax
yep.
overhaul.
The only positive thing that has come out of it, again, just came out, I think, to strip Democrats of a talking point, is
the grad student thing.
It retains the graduate student tuition stipends
yeah.
Benefit because, you know, those grad students were made poster children. It's still just as horrible.
Yeah.
It still keeps the, you know, it still eliminates the deduction for school teachers who buy materials for their classroom. But I guess grad students had a nice, powerful lobbying union or, you know, presented such a pitiful potential political face that the Republicans said, well, okay, we're going to give on that one.
Yeah.
Well, I would actually, love to do an Andrew was wrong on this, but yeah. But I thought it was worth doing a 5 minute just to say, if you think Doug Jones plus Lisa Murkowski plus Susan Collins is going to stop this bill, it's not going to stop the bill.
But if they vote before he's seated, that still is affecting it, right? Or does the, like, they still need 50 votes, don't they?
Right. But Luther Strange will get to vote.
Oh, you're right. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good question. Good, worth doing it. I am also going to link. I called this out on Twitter. The American Bar Association is being ridiculous hypocrites on this. They have circulated a letter because the pass through that there is a ridiculous massive tax cut for pass through organizations. It's going to be a huge loophole.
Yeah.
It's going to cause this to blow an enormous hole in the deficit. That loophole does not apply to law firms over a certain income threshold. It's over $500,000. And so, which you will be happy to know, the law offices of P. Andrew Torres does not come close to that threshold. Yeah. So it doesn't. But for law firms that are passed through and are over $500,000, they're excluded from the tax cut. And so the ABA has circulated this idiotic letter saying, we take no position on the tax bill, but if people are going to be throwing goodies around, by God, we want in on the goodies. So call your senator and lobby them and tell them to not have discrimination against different kinds of organizations in the tax bill.
Yeah.
A much more responsible thing would be call your senator and tell them to vote against this horrible tax bill. But I guess the ABA wants to make sure that they get their hands. If it's raining soup out there, I guess they want to be out there with a pot as well. So,
oh man.
So there we go. Terrible news. Don't think Doug Jones is going to stop this bill. He isn't.
That's depressing. I was hoping that maybe it would at least have some effect on the other alleged moderate Republicans who might reconsider. You know, that gives them more leverage to say, you know, oh, let's delay or let's, you know, but doesn't seem like that's in the cards.
Remember, they want this, right? I mean, this is the area in which Trump has sort of let them be shameless. The
absolute BS skinny repeal in it. Like, I know they, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, you know, Collins, Murkowski and McCain like want all of this. It's like there's enough that they want that they just don't care that they a minute ago said we could never do this. But then once there's some tax breaks in it, they're like, okay, never mind. We could just screw over Obamacare and all that.
Yeah. I let me be very, very specific. Having the corporate tax rate is what Republicans want.
Yeah.
It's what Lisa Murkowski wants. It's what Susan Collin wants. It's what John McCain wants. And as this shows, they don't care what else they have to give up to get that.
Really depressing.
Yep.
All right. All right, you know what's not depressing is thanking our Hall of Fame patrons.
All right. So thank you, our Hall of Fame patrons. In particular, thank you for sticking with us at a time in which Patreon, you know, we've talked about all this. So thank you most sincerely to Heather Loveridge, to This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict, to, as far as you know, Michael Schaefer did not collude with Russia. That's true. To Roger Metcalf in the International Waters, which sounds like a Pink Floyd cover band. Rhonda the Dork, our first patron, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave, co-founder of Florida chapter of Thomas's Goon Squad Nichols, Jim Grove, Ian and Allie, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall. Thank you to Jeffrey Maynor, the Wayward Willis podcast, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Squick Thinger, Aaron Grady, C6 Sarah, Hunter Ash, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Depose, Declawing and Ear Docking, Philip Stromberg, CampQuest.org, 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 Soggy Pants, Sammy, Sam Donnell, and thank you to Andrew and Thomas, know where their towels are. And I might add, we are hoopy frudes as well. So
I don't know what any of that means, but okay.
It's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, okay. I did read the first one and it was very good. Don't murder me, everybody. I like Douglas Adams. I'm on a bad streak with our listeners. And thank you to Greg Sullivan, Malika Chandler, Jesse Studd is my favorite lawyer, Andrew's a close second, Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.blorg, CampQuest.blorg, CampQuest.blorg. Such a stupid thing, but it's so funny. Rebecca Smelzer, Adam Lenda, if you see K-Y-O-U. Purge patron is superior to all others. Detractors will be purged. Keith Davies, Ted Cruz ate my son, so vote Beto in 2018. Jared is sobering up with Yodel Mountain Bottling Co. Clear as Kushner. There should be like something more after that, but I think he ran out of space. Clear as Kushner Ale, maybe. RaymondSpecialties.com, custom survey gear. Senator Doug Mother Effing Jones, Mother Effers. Run Like a Girl. Sakashite Fukusumi, hashtag stop Brexit, hashtag save the NHS, hashtag make Britain great again. Look, Sakashite, we've got our own problems to worry about, okay? Take care of your... So, no, we have many British listeners, and I agree with all that. Frederick Alstromer, Cody Bond, Mitchell, Eric Johnson, stop breaking the law, asshole, Michael 2.9% plus 35 cents, Robs. Hank Scorpio, CEO of the Globex Corporation.
Nice.
The Purge Hospital supports the GOP tax plan. Zabby and Conrad Michaels. Thank you, guys. Oh, I love all the names. They're so funny.
Yep.
Good job on all that. And thank you for sticking with us, like you said, being our top patrons, even in the face of Patreon being ridiculous. With that said, thank you so much for listening. Thank you again. Big shout out to our patrons for sticking with us.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. And we've got a special guest for TTGBE. It is Andrew Seidel. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am well. How are you guys?
Are you sure you're well? You're about to go up against one of the all-time greats here at the bar exam.
Yeah, but, you know, I already am a member of the bar, so I got really nothing to lose. I don't think they're going to take my license away for getting another one wrong. I hope not.
See, now I think of it as you have everything to lose because you notice I don't answer these questions, but
this is true.
I just ask
them. you're nothing without your teacher's edition there, Andrew.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. No, I try and flag the ones that that I think I would have gone the other way on, and I do ask myself the question before I look at the answers, but I do look at the answers. So
may the best lawyer win, everyone. May the best lawyer win. Here we go.
All right, here we go. Pluto was injured as a result of Duck's negligence.
Not a planet. Not a planet. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. It's good to have issue spotting. There's not that many astronomy questions on the bar, so just
damn it. Okay.
Pluto went to Amy, an attorney. That's kind of weird in this. Disney-themed question. Anyway, Pluto went to Amy, an attorney, who agreed to file suit on his behalf on a contingent fee basis. Very common practice. Amy sent Pluto to see Dr. Sawbones, a physician, for the purpose of examining Pluto prior to trial and assessing the extent of his injuries. During the course of the examination, Pluto made some statements to Sawbones indicating that he was not completely free from negligence when the accident occurred. Duck seeks to call Sawbones to testify to the statements Pluto made to Sawbones. Amy objects. Okay, so pretty straightforward. You've got a personal injury case, and the plaintiff goes to Dr. Sawbones, the physician, on advice of counsel, and maybe makes some statements to the physician that are that undercut his case. And so now the question is, the objection by Amy, by Pluto's lawyer, should be A, overruled because Pluto made an admission, B, overruled because a physician qualifies as an expert witness, C, sustained because the attorney-client privilege applies, or D, sustained because the physician-patient privilege applies.
Okay. Give me a second here, Andrews. Man, this I hate these ones with all these wacky characters.
I'm kind of curious as to what statement. Okay, I see. Yeah, I get you.
Gosh, I'm going to say, wow, this is a really hard one. I really hope I can eliminate C. So I got to eliminate two first. I hope I can eliminate C because attorney-client privilege applies. I don't know where that would be because it's statements that Pluto said to Dr. Sawbones. But I would think if Sawbones is evaluating the injuries that that Pluto telling Sawbones stuff during that examination is kind of relevant to what he's even there doing. That's why I can't really decide whether it's because A, overruled because Pluto made an admission is kind of different than overruled. B is overruled because physician qualifies as an expert witness, and D, sustained because the physician patient privilege applies. I would think that, okay, I'm going to eliminate A and C, and I'm just going to hope this is an easy one and go with. This is one of those ones where, like, I don't know if was the doctor appointment intended. Was Dr. Sawbones intended to be an expert witness and testify, you know, to what he saw, or because like the others, how does that work if the other side is calling? I don't know. I hate this new book. I haven't been doing well with this new book. I'm just gonna go with D, sustained because the physician patient privilege applies. I'm doing it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
Andrew.
I think you're right. I mean, I think there are questions. First of all, I think physician-patient privilege is in most jurisdictions. I think there are questions as to scope, and there could be an issue here because Pluto's talking about his own negligence versus his actual injuries or medical things, but it could be related to it. He could have said, you know, for instance, I was a little drunk or something and fell down. I don't know what he could have said, but it could have also been related to how he was injured. So I think D is a pretty good answer here. I'll agree with Thomas.
Yeah. All right. All right. I think last time, if I remember correctly, we agreed last time and we were both wrong.
I think we've agreed every time, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Well, if you would like to agree with Thomas and Andrew,
with our expert panel,
or if you would like to file a minority report and dissent, you can do so. You know how to play along with TTTB. You just take our announcement tweet or post on Facebook and you share that out, include the hashtag TTTB, include your answer, include your reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner and shower that winner with everlasting fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks to Andrew Seidel for a little bit of Thomas Takes the Bar exam there. That's going to be interesting to see who was right on that one. And we'll see you on Tuesday.
Until then.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.